Okay, good afternoon. This is Richard Klemm. It's June 29th today, and we're covering ethics. Today's June 29th program is billed as part four. So those of you taking the podcast, if you're wondering what happened to part three, well, I kind of condensed it into a three-hour session for purposes of the podcast. So you're not missing anything. And we're going to start with Rule 3.1. And as I, for those of you just joining the program, what we are doing is just plodding through the rules of professional conduct as adopted in Wisconsin and Iowa and Minnesota and most other states. We went into quite a bit of detail on some of the earlier rules. And as I warned you in Part 2, we're going to move pretty quickly through Part Rule 3 and Rule 4. For a couple of reasons, most of what we're going to cover in this part of the program is kind of common sense. And you're an ethical attorney; you're not going to do any of this stuff. You're not going to, falsify evidence or destroy evidence or anything like that. And those are kind of the rules that we're covering at this point. And even if you did plan on doing those things, well, me telling you not to probably wouldn't do too much good. So we'll go through them rather quickly. Like I say, you can look through the written materials or, of course, the text of the actual rules to see what is actually covered. But like I say, you're not going to do any of this stuff, so we can move through it pretty quickly. However, there are a couple of things that, an ethical attorney should, if you're going to zealously represent your client, well, sometimes you have to kind of push the envelope a little bit on some of these things. So we'll cover a couple of points that probably deserve a little bit of attention, but like I say, we're not going to go into a whole lot of detail on it. Rule 3.1 says that you're only supposed to make meritorious claims. You're not supposed to file frivolous cases. You're supposed to expedite litigation under Rule 3.2. You shouldn't delay simply for the sake of delay. You should be candid toward the court, not present false evidence, and so forth. Rule 3.4 says that you're supposed to be fair to the other side. You're not supposed to obstruct their access to evidence and so forth. One of these, the last point, and again, most of these you wouldn't do. The last point, though, is one that, the ethical attorney trying to be a nice guy might consider doing this, so you just have to be mindful of the fact that this rule exists, because the rule states that you shall not request somebody other than your client not voluntarily give information to the other party. So it would be tempting sometimes, and maybe even the right thing to do when you're interviewing a witness, not your own client, but interviewing a third-party witness, to let them know that they are under no obligation to speak to the attorney for the other side. And, of course, they're not. They weren't under any obligation to talk to you. You can tell them, well, that other attorney, he's not a very trustworthy attorney, so I recommend you just don't talk to him. That might be the right thing to do in certain circumstances, but you have to be aware that this rule exists because that's exactly what you did. You advised somebody other than a client not to voluntarily give information to the other party. So you have to watch out for that. That doesn't apply if the person you're telling that is a client or an employee of a client, or if you believe that that person's interest will not be adversely affected. So there might be some situations where that would be the proper thing to say, but you have to be aware that, the burden of proof is going to be on you to show that it fits in that exception. You have to be able to show that the other person's interest will not be adversely affected. At this point, I'm going to give the first of several code numbers, again, for this hour of the program. If you're listening to the podcast, the first code number for this hour of the program is E761. E761 is the first code word. Rule 3.5 says you're not supposed to disrupt a tribunal. You're not supposed to have ex parte contact with the jurors and so forth. Again, not stuff that most ethical attorneys would do, so we can gloss over it pretty quickly. In fact, a lot of people taking my program, might kind of tune me out at this point if you, perhaps not involved in litigation in any way. You don't even know where the courthouse is, so you don't you figure you don't have to worry too much about decorum of the tribunal. However, on the question of jury contact, there is one rule that even if that description fits you, that you should be aware of, because the rule says that you're not supposed to have contact with jurors in a case in which you are involved. Well, you're not involved in any cases because you don't do litigation. You do, mergers and whatever. So you don't have to worry about that. However, there's one part of the rule that every attorney should be aware of, and that is that even a lawyer who is not connected with the case is prohibited from communicating with a juror concerning the case. Well, what is the case? What case are we talking about? Well, we're talking about the case you're not involved in. In other words, every case in the world, any jury case, you are prohibited from communicating with a juror concerning the case. So where that could come up is that a friend or neighbor has been selected for jury duty, because you're a lawyer, that's something that they decide to share with you. They say, oh, I got picked for a jury today, and here's what the case is about, and I think the defendant is guilty, and they just start blabbing about the case to you. Well, your neighbor should know better, because the very last thing that the judge told them before they went home for the day is that you were not allowed to talk about the case with anyone. So they're obviously engaging in misconduct that they're not supposed to be doing. But if they blab to their other friends and neighbors, well, their other friends and neighbors are not in trouble. You, on the other hand, are held to a higher standard. So in that situation, not only would your neighbor be in trouble for juror misconduct, but you would be in trouble too, as well as an attorney. We're held to a little bit higher standard of conduct. So in that situation, if that ever arises, make sure you remove yourself from the situation. And of course, even if it's extreme, that would impose upon you an obligation to report that misconduct to the judge in that case, even though you have no involvement in it whatsoever. We do have kind of a proactive duty under this rule to bring forth misconduct that we see. I think if you just walk away from the situation, you would be okay. But if if it is indeed out of hand, well, you might have some further obligation. So, like I say, even if you never engage in any kind of litigation, well, that is still one part of the rule about juror conduct that you have to be aware of. Rule 3.6 talks about trial publicity, and when you read the rule, you get to a bunch of parts about it at the end. Where it says the kinds of things that you're definitely not allowed to talk about because they're kind of a presumption of prejudice, whether or not the defendant has pled guilty and so forth. And you kind of get the impression when you look at this rule, Rule 3.6, that it applies to criminal cases. Well, and it does apply to criminal cases, but you have to watch carefully because Rule 3.6, by its terms, says that it applies to any jury case. So even in a civil case, if you were involved in a case, there are limitations imposed by Rule 3.6 about what you can say publicly about the case. Any attorney participating in litigation can't make public statements if they think that will prejudice the matter before potential jurors. Now, it seems to me that we do have a First Amendment in this country, under the First Amendment, you're allowed to make public statements, and part of the main reason why we have a First Amendment is so that you can prejudice decision makers, so that you can change the mind of decision makers. So it seems to me that you probably do have a First Amendment right to engage in a certain amount of speech about the cases that you're involved in. However, if you do that, I commend you. I think that's a good thing for you to be doing. That's, like I say, why we have a First Amendment, and I'll back you up 100% on it. But you have to be aware that other people might take a different view of it. There is a Rule 3.6. You might be called to task for any public comments you make. Well, the burden is going to be on you to show that you can squeeze that into the First Amendment. Be aware, though, that Rule 3.6 says we're not supposed to make prejudicial statements about any kind of a jury case and also criminal cases. Rule 3.7 says that if you are involved in a case as representing a party, well, then you, if you're representing them in court, you can't appear as a witness in the matter other than, preliminary matters, an affidavit of service or something like that. But in general, you're not allowed to testify in cases in which you are the attorney. If you are a prosecuting attorney or a former prosecutor, you have to be mindful of Rule 3.8. You're not supposed to bring cases that you don't think are supported by probable cause. And also, you have an obligation ongoing, even if you're a former prosecutor, if you ever do become aware that there was a miscarriage of justice in some particular case in which you were involved, or maybe even a case in which you were not involved, you might have an obligation to come forward with that. I believe it's the Wisconsin version of the rule that makes very clear that that's an ongoing obligation that that continues forever. And I think even though other states don't have quite the same language, I think that would probably apply in other states as well, that that's kind of an ongoing obligation. If you ever become aware of a case in which you were involved where it turns out the defendant is not guilty, well, you have an obligation to correct that going forward. Rule 3.9 talks about your duties as an advocate in non-adjudicative proceedings. So in other words, you are representing somebody before a city council or a legislative committee or an administrative agency. And Rule 3.9 simply makes clear that you have an obligation to reveal, to disclose the fact that you are there in a representative capacity. You don't necessarily have to identify who your client is, but you can't simply go to the legislature and testify in favor of a bill and try to pass yourself off as a concerned citizen when you are actually there as a lobbyist, when you are actually there being paid by somebody else or representing somebody, I guess, whether or not you're paid. You have to disclose that you are there in a representative capacity. Rule 4 talks about your duties to the kind of the general public. And 4.1 again says, well, you and I are ethical attorneys. We wouldn't do this. We wouldn't lie to third parties in representing somebody. The rule says that you cannot make a false statement of material fact to a third party in connection with the representation. Well, again, that's easy to say, and I think most of us would agree with that. There might be some cases, though, where you as a zealous attorney have to engage in maybe some level of deception. Those of you in Wisconsin, you have a little bit more clarity in that regard because the Wisconsin version of the rule makes clear that a legitimate investigative technique is okay. And what the example that they give is a tester in a civil case. So in other words, you are representing somebody who thinks that they were discriminated against in housing because of their race. Normally people who do discrimination don't admit to it. You have to prove the case by circumstantial evidence. Well, a good way to get that circumstantial evidence is you send in testers to see if there's any discrimination going on. So you hire an actor. You hire two actors, one black person and one white person, and you send them into the apartment that said that they didn't have any apartments available, and the white person says, hello, I want to rent an apartment, and they are shown an apartment and offered a lease, and the black person is told, I'm sorry, we don't have any apartments available right now. Well, that's a very, you did the right thing, in my opinion. You ferreted out some wrongdoing, but you have to be aware that Rule 4.1 says you're not supposed to make false statements to third parties, and that's exactly what these people did, these people who were acting on your behalf. They made the false statement of, I want to rent an apartment, because they didn't want to rent an apartment. They were simply there to gather evidence. Now, again, the Wisconsin version of this rule makes clear that that's an acceptable thing for you to do. Other states' versions of it do not have that exception written in. However, most states do have an ethics opinion on the subject, and most states that I've seen say that that is permissible, even though you do have people making false statements on your behalf. So anytime you engage in any level of deception like that, you have to be careful, and you have to be aware that Rule 4.1 is there, and you probably want to dig out those state ethics opinions and see exactly what they have to say. Like I say, it's easy to say that, well, we never make false statements to third parties. Sometimes you have to, you have to be very careful because Rule 4.1 says that in general you're not supposed to do that. Another area where you could run into trouble with those testers is in Rule 4.2, because you are not permitted to communicate with people that you know are represented by an attorney. So in that example, probably if you are aware that that apartment complex is represented by an attorney, well, you probably can't send in your testers because that is direct communication with a party that you know is represented by an attorney. So I guess the advice there is to do that before they get lawyered up, because once they are represented by an attorney, well, then it probably is an absolute bar and you can't send people in to talk directly to them. If you're dealing with unrepresented persons, Rule 4.3 covers that situation. If that person has a misunderstanding, you're dealing with this unrepresented person and they think that you're on their side, you're acting in their best interest, do you have an obligation to clear that up? And those unrepresented persons, you cannot give them any legal advice other than the legal advice to seek that they ought to find their own attorney. But you can't state or imply that you're disinterested in it somehow. You have to respect the rights of third parties. You can't use vexatious means of gathering evidence and so forth. So, again, Rule 3 and Rule 4, we glossed over them. We spent 2 hours talking about Rule 1, and we glossed over Rules 3 and 4 very, very quickly. So I don't want you to get the idea that those are unimportant rules, because, obviously they're important. But, again, most, other than some of those fine points we talked about, most of the stuff there is pretty much common sense that most of us wouldn't do anyway. But like I say, if you want more detail, you can look over those materials and or the rules in your estate. Rule 5 talks about some of your obligations with respect to other people in your office. Rule 5.1 and 5.3 talks about whether or not you can get into trouble for the things that your employees do wrong. So if your employee commits a violation of the rules, are you liable for it? Rule 5.1 and 5.3 talk about that. And they're pretty much the same rule, except they're worded a little bit differently, because your non-lawyer employers can't really violate the rules because they don't have any rules. They're not lawyers. But in general, the same obligations apply. Obviously, if you direct one of your employees to commit a violation of the rules, well, obviously you are you're just as liable for the violation as the person you told to do it. So you go tell your secretary, prepare this forged document for me. Well, obviously you are liable for that. More importantly, you have an obligation to make sure that there are systems in place to, if you have any kind of managerial authority over other people, you have to make sure that there are reasonable steps in place to make sure that everybody acts in conformity with the rules. For example, that you're not supposed to embezzle money from your trust account, and you can tell your bookkeeper not to embezzle money in your trust account, you need to have some system in place to catch it, something reasonable. Just about every embezzlement you hear about, the trusted church secretary or, the trusted paralegal who takes care of the trust account, you know, most of those cases, when you hear about it, you know, most of them could have been prevented with just a modicum of oversight. I think the best way to make sure problems like that don't happen is, you know, if you just, you know, can't deal with your trust account and you hire somebody you trust to take care of it, that's fine. But you have to have a certain amount of oversight in place. And a lot of times that might be something as simple as when the bank statement arrives, it comes directly to you and you are the one who opens the bank statement. You know, maybe you can't understand, you know, why this, you know, why this item for $3.22 was for. Maybe you can look over that. But if you start seeing, you know, checks made out to cash that are cashed at the casino, well, then you realize that that's probably not a legitimate use of your trust account. More often than not, these you know, embezzlement cases by the trusted bookkeeper, usually they wind up involving you know, checks made out to cash. Or one case I saw recently, the somebody is going to jail for embezzlement from some nonprofit. Well, there were checks made out to, you know, the cable TV company and the water company. Well, you know, they're kind of short on cash, so they used this checkbook that they had to pay their own personal bills. Well, that's the kind of thing that you would catch. And Rule 5.1 and 5.3 says that you have an obligation to take steps like that. So that's Rule 5.1 and 5.3 covers the situation if you are the boss. You know, the things that you can get in trouble for what your employees do. Rule 5.2 covers the duties of the subordinate lawyer. So in other words, can you get in trouble for the things that your boss does? The rule makes clear that the "I was only following orders" defense is not a defense. You can't say, well, yes, I committed this violation, but my boss told me to. Well, you are still liable. With one exception, and that exception is if it's an arguable case, you're not sure exactly what you're supposed to do, so you go to your boss and ask, "Boss, what should I do in this situation? You know, can I take this case even though it looks like it's kind of sort of a conflict of interest?" And your boss says, "Yes, you can do that." Well, in that limited situation, as long as it's an arguable question and as long as you've got reasonable advice from your supervising attorney, then you can say, "I was only following orders." But the orders were reasonable and it was an arguable case. That's the one time when you can say, "I was only following orders." And at this point, I'll give our next code number for the podcast listeners. It is E-740. E-740, E as in ethics, 740, E-740 is the next code number. Rule 5.4, professional independence of a lawyer. Sounds like a very lofty ethical title. It doesn't say anything about professional independence, though. It just says you're not supposed to share your fee with a non-lawyer. You can never enter into any kind of agreement where part of your law office's law fees go to non-attorneys or part of the, any part of the fee. There's some exceptions that are kind of more technical exceptions, sharing the fee with the estate of an attorney who is deceased. Well, obviously, the estate of an attorney is not an attorney, but you can still share it with them. If you have a profit-sharing plan for your office and you have everything, that's obviously well beyond the scope of this. If you comply with all those requirements, that's okay. But in general, you can't have any kind of system where you share your fees with a non-attorney. So that means that you can't be part of a partnership with a non-attorney if part of the partnership is the practice of law. So, for example, if you, an attorney, enter into a partnership with a CPA, to do combination legal work and CPA work, and you're not a CPA and the other person is not an attorney, well, you would have to come up with some other mechanism other than a partnership in order to do that. Rule 5.5 says that you can't engage in the unauthorized practice of law. Well, except it doesn't say that because, well, you can't engage in the unauthorized practice of law because you're a lawyer. And if you weren't a lawyer, the rules don't apply to you. So the rule doesn't actually say that. It says you can't assist third parties in the unauthorized practice of law. But more importantly, where the issue comes up is in multi-jurisdictional kinds of things. So you, for example, are admitted to practice law in Wisconsin. You're not admitted in Iowa. Well, can you go to Iowa to take a deposition, or do you have to hire a local attorney to do that for you? And this rule answers that question. Now, the one thing to keep in mind is that if you're a Wisconsin attorney, you don't have to worry too much about Wisconsin Rule 5.5. So in this case, when you're doing something in another jurisdiction, you really have to be concerned with what the other state's rule is on that subject. And fortunately, most of the states are about the same that we'll be talking about, but not all of them. About 40-some states follow the same rules that we're talking about today, the ABA Model Code of Professional Responsibility. Some states don't, though. And one notable example, for example, is California. I had a potential client from California contact me that wanted me to do something for them. Being familiar with Minnesota Rule 5.5 and Wisconsin Rule 5.5, it would have been no problem. It was something that I could have easily done for a Wisconsin resident because the Wisconsin Rule 5.5 said that I'm permitted to do that. But fortunately, I took a minute and looked up the California rule, and it turns out I was not allowed to do that in California. In fact, it would have been a criminal offense for me to do that in California. So it's a good thing I took a look at the rule before I got to work. And then I had to explain to this potential client, say, no, I don't want to touch this one. Find yourself a local attorney who will charge you a lot more than I would. But that's what I had to say in that case. But as long as we're not dealing with California, if I decide to go to Wisconsin, or if I decide to go to Iowa, or if you in Wisconsin decide to go to Minnesota, pretty much the same rules apply, and you're actually allowed to do quite a bit. So, so for right now, you're probably a Wisconsin attorney or an Iowa attorney listening to this program. We'll take a look at Minnesota Rule 5.5. You have a deposition that you have to do in Minnesota. So you get out Minnesota Rule 5.5. And it says you're not supposed to practice law in this state, but if you are admitted in another state, such as Wisconsin, you may provide the following kind of services on a temporary basis. So here's what you're allowed to do in Minnesota, as long as you're not suspended or disbarred. Well, you're probably not suspended or disbarred, but I want to highlight one point about that in a minute. Here's what you're allowed to do. You're admitted in another state. You're allowed to operate in association with a lawyer who is admitted in the state. So if you come here to serve as my co-counsel in a particular case, that's fine. You don't have to get admitted for that. Now, there might be court rules that say to appear in court, you have to be admitted, but you're not engaging in the unauthorized practice of law just by helping me out with my Minnesota case. Or if you, if I hire you to write an appeal or something, that's fine. Things that are reasonably related to a pending or potential case, if you reasonably believe that you will be permitted to appear in the case. That actually is kind of is wide open. It allows you to do quite a bit of stuff in other states. So, for example, you are contacted by a Minnesota client, and they have a lawsuit that they plan on filing in federal court in Minnesota. You're admitted in Wisconsin. You are not admitted in Minnesota, and this case can't be filed in Wisconsin. It has to be filed in Minnesota. Well, it turns out you can just get right to work on that. You can give the person advice about Minnesota law. You can interview witnesses. You can do just about anything that a Minnesota attorney would be allowed to do because you happen to know that the rules of the Minnesota Federal District Court will allow you to appear in the case as a relatively simple matter. You just have to apply to the court, and you will be permitted to appear in Minnesota. And you can get right to work even before you're admitted, because you reasonably believe that you will be admitted to practice. So that actually gives a great deal of flexibility on multi-state things, as long as it's something that you will reasonably be allowed to appear in court in connection with it. And then finally, what you are allowed to do in this state, the rule makes clear that you can do things in this state that are connected with your practice at home. So you have a Wisconsin case pending, you're admitted in Wisconsin, and you are planning on taking a deposition in Minnesota. Yes, you can come here to take the deposition, and you don't have to hire a local attorney to take the deposition, because that's reasonably related to your case back home. So it's actually in connection with federal law or administrative law. So if you represent people in the Federal Communications Commission, even though you're not admitted in Minnesota, you can come to Minnesota to meet with your Minnesota radio station clients, because that's authorized by federal law. So it's pretty wide open what you're allowed to do. But the threshold requirement for that is that you have to be admitted in some state, and you can't be disbarred or suspended anywhere. Well, again, you don't plan on getting disbarred or suspended. But where that could potentially cause a problem is if you're admitted in more than one state and you decide to let your registration in some other state lapse. So, for example, you are admitted in Iowa and Texas. So you're admitted to practice law in those two states. Well, every year you get a bill from the Texas Supreme Court to renew your license, and you send them the $500 that they want or whatever. But then it occurs to you, well, you know, I don't practice law in Texas. I'm based here in Iowa. I don't have any Texas cases. That's kind of a waste of my money. So you decide just to throw away the renewal notice and not pay it this year. Well, you have to be careful whenever you do that, because you want to make sure that you do that in such a way that you don't get suspended in Texas. Because if you get suspended in Texas for non-payment of your bar dues, well, then you're in trouble, because not because of your practice in Iowa, because you're admitted there. You don't need a Texas license to practice in Iowa. But if you ever come to Minnesota to take your deposition, well, according to the terms of the rules, you are suspended in some jurisdiction. So therefore, you're not allowed to take this deposition in Minnesota. So that's something you want to watch out for if you are admitted in multiple states like that. Now, it's less of a problem for me because that doesn't apply to me, but if it did apply to me and I went to Wisconsin to take a deposition, the Wisconsin version of this rule makes clear that if the suspension is for something like non-payment of my bar dues, that's not a big deal. They don't worry about that. But if you're a Wisconsin attorney, that only applies to attorneys from the other 49 states. So you would be a little bit out of luck if you're a Wisconsin attorney suspended in Florida for non-payment of your bar dues. Well, then theoretically you couldn't come to Minnesota to take a deposition. So you want to watch out for that. Another issue that comes up is, and this is treated a little bit differently from different states, and I think today's program will have mostly Iowa, Wisconsin attorneys, so we'll talk about that. What about if you get a job in for a company that your in-house counsel for a company that has offices all over the country, and you get transferred to another state? Well, that actually varies quite a bit from state to state. Some states don't really address the question too much. For example, the Minnesota rule doesn't go into a lot of detail on that about what the obligations of the out-of-state attorney are. So, for example, you work for Wells Fargo. It's a bank with offices all over the country, and you get transferred to the Minnesota office. Well, it's a little bit up in the air in Minnesota. You probably just have to look at the other state versions of the rules. Iowa, on the other hand, is much more amenable to that. So if I get a job for a company and I get transferred to Iowa, well, then the Iowa version of the rule makes very clear that I can do just about anything that my Iowa admitted colleagues can do, even though I'm not admitted in the state. They kind of cover that situation. Other states like Wisconsin and Nebraska have a provision that say, yes, you can do that, but you need to file a special sort of registration with the Wisconsin or Nebraska Supreme Court for that specific category. Because they have a category for out-of-state attorneys not admitted in the state who are in-house counsel for multi-state companies. So if I got a job in Iowa, or if I got a job with the company and they transferred me to Iowa, there really wouldn't be a lot I would have to do. If that same company transferred me to Wisconsin, then I would have to register as an out-of-state attorney with the Wisconsin Supreme Court. Wisconsin, it seems that that procedure is pretty perfunctory. On the other hand, Nebraska, it's an extremely expensive proposition. So if I ever got transferred to Nebraska, it would probably be easier for me just to get admitted in Nebraska rather than send them like $1,000 or something just for this out-of-state license. So again, that will vary somewhat from state to state, so you have to watch out for that. I forget if I gave the next number here, so I'll just go ahead and give it again. I don't think I did. The next code number, or maybe I already gave this, is E-792. I think it is new. E-792 is the next code word for the podcast listeners. Rule 5.6 says that you can't, that lawyers can't have non-compete agreements. So if you you can't tell your former employees, sign this non-compete agreement because that restricts your right to practice law. Where you have to watch out is if you are not employed as an attorney and you sign a non-compete agreement as part of some other employment relationship, well, you better make sure that it in no way restricts your ability to practice law because that would be a violation for you simply signing that, even if perhaps it was unenforceable. So you want to watch out for that. Rule 5.7 talks about law-related services. And Rule 5.7 answers the question of if I'm an attorney but I'm doing things that do not constitute the practice of law, am I still bound by the rules of professional conduct? So, for example, tax preparation. Let's say I decide to do tax preparation instead of the practice of law. Well, that's anybody can be a tax preparer. You don't need to have a law degree to do that. You don't need to be admitted as an attorney. So people who are doing tax preparation, if I go to H&R Block, I'm sure they have rules governing them, but they're not the same rules. They don't have to worry about conflicts of interest. They don't have to worry about the same confidentiality rules we do. But if I did tax preparation, would I have to worry about those rules? And yes, I would if it's not distinct from the practice of law, or if the clients mistakenly believe that there is an attorney-client relationship, then the same rules of professional conduct would apply. I have in Rule 5 in the materials here, Minnesota Rule 5.8. As far as I know, that's not adopted in Wisconsin or Iowa or any other state. But it talks about employing somebody who is a disbarred attorney. Well, don't do it because they got disbarred for a reason. You don't want them working for you. But if you're in Minnesota, there are specific rules governing that, including notifying the Office of Lawyers' Professional Responsibility, which you don't want to send that notification. So moving on to Rule 6 is, again, another one we're going to gloss over a little bit because it talks about pro bono. And Rule 6.1 tells you that you have an obligation to do pro bono, And, well, what is your obligation? We all know that we're supposed to do that. Well, your obligation is to provide at least, or is to aspire to provide at least 50 hours of pro bono service per year. You don't have to actually do it, but you do have to aspire to do it. So, you know, your New Year's resolution should be, I will do 50 hours of pro bono this year. And then you are in compliance. On the other hand, if you, you know, on January 2nd, you wake up and you say, I'm not going to do my pro bono, well, you've committed a violation right then because you stopped aspiring. So that's what your obligation is. And those 50 hours is not just any public service kind of activity. It's specifically providing legal services to those without the ability to pay for legal services, to persons of limited means, and to organizations that help persons of limited means. In addition to that, the rule says you're supposed to do things like protect the environment and fight for civil rights and things like that, but that's in addition to that 50 hours of helping persons of limited means. Well, we know we're supposed to do pro bono. The rest of Rule 6 goes into some detail of, well, there are kind of special conflict of interest rules in a lot of these pro bono activities. So, for example, when Rule 6.2 says you should not try to avoid taking appointments by the court. Rule 6.3 talks about the conflict of interest rules regarding if you're a member of a legal services organization. So one of the things you're supposed to do is you're supposed to be active in the community and be the Legal Aid Society says they want you as a board member. Well, that's a laudable thing for you to do. But you have to be mindful of conflicts of interest, but the conflict of interest rules are a little bit relaxed in that situation. Because, for example, you represent landlords in your private practice, but you want to give back to the community, so you're on the board of directors of the legal services organization. And this legal services organization represents the tenants who are suing your private clients. Well, in a normal situation, that would be a huge conflict of interest because you're representing both sides. You know, you represent the landlords in your private practice, and then you're on the board of this corporation that represents the tenants who are suing them. So that would be a huge conflict of interest. But in that limited situation of being on the board or an officer of a legal services organization, that is okay, but you basically have to recuse yourself in cases where there's a conflict of interest. You can't participate in those decisions, but you don't have to resign your membership just because they are suing your private clients. If you were supposed to engage in law reform activities, we want to improve the law, so you go down to the legislature or you're a member of the Bar Association committee that's writing a revision of the landlord-tenant law, maybe your private clients are like the law the way it is, you know, unreformed. Well, in that situation, you're still allowed to advocate for those changes, even though your private clients might suffer. And that's under Rule 6.4. And at this point, I'll give our next code number for the podcast listeners, E749. E749. Rule 6.5 talks about the situation of you being at a limited legal services program. So you're a volunteer attorney at the law school or at the Bar Association for a clinic kind of thing where people come in and talk to an attorney about their problems. Well, this rule makes clear that if you are aware of an actual conflict of interest, then it's conflict of interest like any other. But if you're not aware of the conflict of interest, this gives you a little bit of a safe harbor. So you work for insurance companies during the day, but you're volunteering at the legal clinic, and some people come in with this horror story about something an insurance company has done to them, and you tell these people, well, you should sue the insurance company. That's terrible, these things that they've done to you. Sue them into bankruptcy. Well, it turns out they didn't tell you the name of the insurance company, but it's actually your client that you just advised these people to sue. Well, in that situation where you were not aware of the conflict of interest in that limited clinic setting, then that's okay. Okay, Rule 7 talks about communication with the public and advertising kinds of things. You can't be false or misleading in any public communications. Rule 7.2 says that you are allowed to advertise, and you're allowed to advertise in just about any state, including Iowa, where the rules changed about 2 or 3 years ago. They were quite restrictive, but they kind of got in line with, well, the First Amendment. And yes, you are allowed to advertise now. You are not allowed to get referral fees. As we mentioned in an earlier part of the program, there are situations where you can share a fee with another attorney. And if you only learn one thing from the from this program, what you should learn is that never call it a referral fee if some other attorney sends you some money, because you have to pretend that it's not a referral fee. Because, and Rule 7.2 is what says that you can't take referral fees. You shall not give anything of value to anybody to recommend your services. Well, that's exactly what a referral fee is. You're paying somebody to refer cases to you, and that is not permitted. So if you're going to do that, you better pretend that it's something else, and don't call it a referral fee. But one of the exceptions to that is if it's a legitimate advertisement. So if you pay the reasonable costs of to the newspaper or the radio station to recommend you, well, that's what advertising is, and that's permitted. It can't be false or misleading. Really, the only substantive restriction on advertising these days is that the advertisement has to include the name of at least one attorney or law firm who is responsible for the ad. So you can't just put up a billboard that says, you know, injured, call 1-800-INJURED. Well, you have to put your name on there somewhere, or the name of your firm. But other than that, advertising is pretty much wide open these days. Rule 7.3, including what you're allowed to do under Rule 7.3, and that is send letters directly to people you know might be in need of legal services. So you go down to the jail on Monday and get the names of everybody who's arrested and say, I understand you need a lawyer, here I am. Or the, you know, the people who have civil judgments against them advertising your bankruptcy services or whatever. That is okay, but it has to be in writing. You can't make telephone contact with such people or personal contact. It has to be written contact. And there's some very explicit language that you have to include. You have to and check your state's rule on what it is. Most states, you have to have the word advertising material printed on the advertisement and the outside envelope. And there's even a requirement as to what size typeface you have to use. But that that language varies from state. For example, Nebraska, you have to use the words, this is an advertisement. But you have to use those magic words, so make sure that you do that. And the Iowa rule changed a couple of years ago. So if you have a bunch of old envelopes that you were using for those, well, you have to throw away those old envelopes and use the new ones because the language changed. You're allowed to say what you do for a living. Under Rule 7.4, you can communicate your fields of practice. You can say that you limit your practice to a certain area. You can say that you take especially this kind of case or whatever. You have to be very careful, though, if you use the word certified or specialist or any variation of those terms, because then some specific rules come in. And there was a recent case, I think, from New York, where they're maybe a little bit more stickler about such things, where some hapless attorney had on his LinkedIn profile language to the effect of, I specialize in tough cases, and he used the word specialized. He was not a certified specialist by the American Academy of Tough Cases, so he actually got in trouble for using the word specialize. So if he had said, I like tough cases, well, it wouldn't have been a problem, but he used the word specialize, and you have to watch out for that. The rules governing governing that vary a little bit from state to state, but if you are certified, basically You have to be truthful about what that what your specialization is. In Minnesota, it has to either be accredited by or by the Minnesota Board of Legal Certification. So you can say, I'm a real property specialist by the Minnesota Trial Lawyers. Well, that doesn't make any sense. I'm a certified real property specialist by the Minnesota State Bar Association. That's okay because the Minnesota State Bar Association is authorized to hand out that certification. Wisconsin, I believe, has a similar procedure in place. And if I'm certified by somebody else, then I have to put some fine print saying this is not recognized by the Minnesota or Wisconsin Supreme Court. Iowa does not have such a certification in place. So in Iowa, you have to say, you have to include the language, the Iowa Supreme Court does not certify specialists in any particular area. So if you ever use, like I say, watch out for the term certified and specialist. If you use those in any kind of advertising or public communication, watch out. Firm names and letterheads, I don't know, letterhead used to be a big deal, not quite so much anymore with word processors, but firm names is still kind of a big deal. Because you are, including Iowa, where the rule changed a couple of years ago, you are allowed to use a trade name for the practice of law. That was not the case before. So if the two attorneys in your office were named Smith and Jones, you could call your firm Smith and Jones. You could call it Jones and Smith. But you could not call yourself, Hawkeye Trial Lawyers, because that was a trade name. You were not allowed to do that. Well, that's changed, so you are allowed to do that now in Iowa, and you've always been able to do it for a long time in other states like Wisconsin. What you have to watch out for is you have to be careful that you don't imply a connection with a government agency or a public or charitable legal services organization. And where you can run into trouble there is the use of geographic names. So, for example, you are located in Dane County, Wisconsin. If you were a plumber, you could put on your trucks Dane County Plumbers, not a problem. But on your lawyer truck, you better not put Dane County Attorneys because there's a government agency with that same name. So it's best to avoid geographic names like that. You don't want to call yourself Wisconsin State Attorneys. You probably call yourself Badger State Attorneys or something. That would be okay. But be really careful if you use the name of something that's also a political subdivision because you might imply that you're connected. One state, this doesn't make a whole lot of sense to me, but one state said that the use of the word clinic implies that you're a charitable organization. I don't know, most medical clinics aren't charitable organizations. They're a for-profit business, so I don't know why lawyers are different. But in that state, anyway, they said that the word clinic implied that you were a non-profit, so you want to watch out for that. In Iowa and Wisconsin, we don't have this in Minnesota. I don't know why not. But basically, you're not supposed to pay bribes. Specifically, Rule 8.6 says that you shall not accept a government engagement or appointment if you made political contributions for the purposes of being considered. So if you donate money to the next governor and the governor appoints you as judge, perhaps you violated that if that was your motivation. Like I say, we don't have that in Minnesota because I guess maybe they can't enforce it or something. But it is the rule in Wisconsin and Iowa. Okay, wrapping it up here in the next 5 minutes or so. Rule 8.1 says that you have to be truthful in dealing with your state bar, not only in your case but in anybody else's case. People who are candidates to become newly admitted attorneys. You shall not knowingly or recklessly make false statements about judges or any public legal officer. So if you're going to say that uh, some some judge is a crook. Well, you better make sure that you're right, because you have to watch out for that. And that also applies to candidates for judicial office. So if somebody in Minnesota, where we have contested judicial elections, if somebody is running for judge and I say they're a crook, well, I better be right, because I can't knowingly or recklessly make a false statement about their qualifications or integrity. Rule 8.3 says that if you learn that another lawyer or judge has violated the rules, well, you have an affirmative obligation to turn them in, unless you learned that information because of your attorney-client relationship with that person. So in other words, your attorney-client confidentiality trumps your obligations under Rule 8.3. Or if you were a counselor in a lawyer assistance program, then that information is also confidential, and you don't have to report it under Rule 8.3. 8.4 lists all the miscellaneous stuff that they forgot about when they wrote the rules. And every state has a little bit different laundry list of miscellaneous things that will get you in trouble. So look over Rule 8.4 for your state to make sure there's no miscellaneous things. Like in Nebraska, not paying your child support is a specific violation. So you have to watch out for that. Well, finally, Rule 8.5, we talked about some of these multi-state kinds of things that can take place. And before we do that, I'll give the last code number before we wrap up, because we're maybe going over an hour a little bit here. So the very last code number for this portion of the program before we wrap up in 2 minutes is E798 is the last code number for this portion of the program. But we'll just wrap up with Rule 8.5, because we talked about some of these multi-state things. Well, what state law applies? Well, first of all, Rule 8.5 makes clear that you are subject to disciplinary authority maybe in more than one state. You're subject to discipline in the state where you're admitted or in states where you offer legal services in any way. So, for example, when I go to Wisconsin to take that deposition in my Minnesota case, I'm permitted to do that, but I am then subject to discipline by the Wisconsin Supreme Court. So if I do something wrong when I'm in Wisconsin, even though I'm not admitted in Wisconsin, the state of the Wisconsin Supreme Court has jurisdiction to discipline me if I commit any violations there. The other question is choice of law. Well, if I'm over there taking this deposition in the Wisconsin case, in most cases the rules are identical, but what if there's a difference between the rules? Which state's law applies? And one real practical way that came up is I had a Michigan attorney taking the program who was also admitted in some other state. I forget if it was Minnesota or Wisconsin. But lo and behold, in Michigan, they do have referral fees. That's okay. They don't pretend that there's something else. They just pay referral fees to other attorneys, and the state of Michigan is okay with that. Well, her question was, she's admitted in Michigan and Wisconsin, so what happens if she gets a referral fee? Would that be okay? Would she get in trouble with the Minnesota Supreme Court? And so that's the kind of question that this choice of law provision answers. There are a number of tests. First of all, if it's conduct before a tribunal, then that state's law applies. And that would probably apply in her case because it was, a case pending before a Michigan court. So it would probably be Michigan law that applies, so the referral fee would be okay. Or the other rules are, for other conduct, if you're admitted in only one state, then that state's laws apply. So if you're admitted in Wisconsin and you get a referral fee from Michigan, well, that's not permissible. Because you're bound by the Wisconsin rules. If you're admitted in more than one state, which was her case, then the rules of the state where you principally practice apply. So in her case, she principally practiced in Michigan, so the Michigan referral fee was probably okay, unless the conduct had predominant effect in another jurisdiction. So if she got a referral fee in a Minnesota case, or you know, one of the litigants was a Minnesota resident, but in her case, she got a referral fee from a Michigan case that from a Michigan plaintiff against a Michigan defendant that was going to be filed in Michigan, and you know, the other state didn't really have anything to do with it. Well, I see we're in about an hour. We did manage to plod through all the material. I'll give that last code number again. The very last code number was E798. Well, I will pause briefly for the live callers if you have any questions.
No.
Well, hearing none.
Go ahead.
Okay. Okay, I can get them after recording too. So, well, thank you for joining me. We plotted through all of it. If you do have any questions, feel free to either email me or call me during the program. Depending on what your state is, the instructions for claiming credit will differ slightly, but mostly entail getting those code numbers to me. So thank you once again for joining us, and look forward to seeing you at future programs.